There was once a mother who gave birth to a child in secret, placed him in a basket of bulrushes sealed with bitumen, and cast the basket adrift on the river. It so happened the child was miraculously found, rescued, and rose to become king. So is told the origins of Sargon of Akkad in 2300 BCE, 1,000 years before Moses. The Moses birth narrative is part of the legendary liberation of the Hebrews from Egypt, a land where they had allegedly been treated as slaves. The story is well known. Pharaoh was reluctant to let the people go, and so to force his hand, their God sent 10 fearful plagues. The Nile was turned to blood, the land ravaged by locusts and frogs, and finally, all firstborn Egyptian sons were killed by divine edict. It's not difficult for us today to understand a community living by a river delta could be afflicted by algal blooms, plagues, and disease, and how such things in time could be ascribed to a deity in retribution for human actions and be woven into a mythical story. That mythical story continues with Pharaoh then acceding to the Hebrews' request, but later changing his mind. His army chased the exiting Israelites and caught up with them at the Sea of Reeds. Their God opened the sea, allowing the chosen Israelites safe passage and drowning the Egyptians. Well, there's considerable debate in the academic community about whether any of this happened, including whether Moses existed and whether even one tribe of the Israelites once resided in Egypt. There's only two extra-biblical sources. One is a 13th century text of the Pharaoh Ramses II, who mentions a group of people called Aparu in building operations. But this term seems to refer to a social class rather than an ethnic group. Was this Exodus episode then a successful peasants' revolt and Moses a trade union leader? If it was, it would have been a rare occurrence at the time and made a lasting impression. The other mention is of Israel in an Egyptian text dated about 1230 BCE, but it refers to Israel as a people encountered by the Egyptians in Canaan, read modern-day Israel-Palestine. The Egyptian Empire at that time, called the Egyptian West Asiatic Empire, spread right from Egypt, if you imagine a map of the Middle East, right across to the Euphrates. And in that region, there are a number of tribes who, in time, came to constitute the Hebrews. The collapse of that empire in the 13th century BCE may have well given a sense of liberation to minorities within the empire, and may even have facilitated the physical movement of some of these peoples. I think the bigger problem for us is not the historical accuracy, but what this story says about God. God is portrayed as a murderous deity who has little compassion for anyone but his own favorites. Surprisingly, as it may seem, in time the Israelites would transform this God into a symbol of transcendence and compassion. And yet this one-eyed, vengeful God is continually resuscitated and brought out of antiquity whenever we want a deity who is unequivocally on our side. The notion of God is particularly vulnerable to being exploited and abused. The myth of a chosen people has often inspired a narrow tribal theology. From the time of the Exodus author, who wrote about the 7th century BCE, right up to modern-day Jewish, Muslim, and Christian fundamentalism. I think one of our tasks today is to talk about our bias, broadly defined by the lived theology of Jesus, towards those on the margins of our society, without demonizing those who disagree with and oppose us. If we believe that God is that spirit of justice and compassion who takes the side of the most vulnerable, then we need to also hold to the belief that the Spirit's purpose in taking sides is to bring us all in time into an equitable community where everyone is valued and loved, including our enemies. This last week, we have farewelled our former Governor-General and Bishop, Sir Paul Reeves, a great friend of St. Matthew's. In the funeral speeches, there was plenty of recognition of his ability to listen, to laugh, and to build bridges. However, you don't build a bridge by standing in the middle. And Sir Paul definitely stood on one side, or rather with those relegated to the sidelines, like women, Maori, gays, and lesbians. Speaking of women, let's return to the Moses birth narrative. For the real importance of it is not its historical accuracy, the storytellers probably having borrowed a well-known miracle birth scenario, but its real importance is in the extolling of courage. Courage is a word I often use when I want to talk about faith. It's also a good word to use for God. God is experienced when we act with courage on behalf of the vulnerable. The difference between the account of Sargon's birth and Moses's are five women. Firstly, there's Shiphrah and Puah, Hebrew midwives, my heroes. Pharaoh wanted them to murder the male babies. Shiphrah and Puah refuse. The penalty for refusing would have been death. When summoned to Pharaoh, they lied. The Hebrew women are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes. Yeah, right. Shiphrah and Puah were health professionals in the best sense of that word, putting the needs of their patients before the dictates of their overlord. Honesty is sometimes not the best policy. Saving children takes precedence. We're next introduced to Moses' mother, whom we know from other texts is called Jochebed, and his sister Miriam. Bravery, again, is to the fore. After his birth, Jochebed hides Moses in her house for 3 months, stifling every little cry for fear that a neighbor or stranger might betray them. Then in time, the family decides to place Moses in a basket down by the riverside, ironically fulfilling Pharaoh's requirements that babies be thrown in the river. There, Miriam stays and watches over her little baby brother. Note the courage of Miriam when the princess finds Moses coming forward rather than scuttling off and bravely offering a wet nurse, her mother, for the babe. And accountants take note. See, that mother got paid for wet nursing. The princess could have easily had the baby thrown into the deep. It would have been easy to surmise or see the connection between Moses and Miriam and deal with Miriam as one would with a lawbreaker. Princess realized that the baby was one of those despised others, a Hebrew. She also knows that her father has asked every Egyptian to throw these babies to the death. yet she feels her heart moved with pity and courageously acts on the basis of that feeling. The stunning part of the story, and the part that alerts us that here we have a princess worthy of the title. Royalty, by the way, is about using your power for good, not pretty pictures and smiles and fashion magazines. And she's worthy of that title of princess because she claims and names Moses as her son. To save the baby's life, she could have taken him as a slave. That would have got Daddy's attention. If she liked Moses, she could have had him castrated and elevated to the status of a royal eunuch. Yet instead, she takes this outcast immigrant child of the race her father detests and invites him into the royal inner sanctum as her son. Five courageous women, four Jewish, one Egyptian, saving the life of a baby whose only crime was to be born of the wrong race and of the wrong gender. I don't believe in a God that sends plagues, kills babies, opens seas of reeds, or drowns armies. I do believe in a God who is the compassion we offer to the vulnerable, the tears and cares that we offer to the suffering, and the courage we exhibit in order to try and make a difference. I don't believe in a God who has a chosen people and therefore relegates others to an unchosen status. I do believe in a God who speaks and acts in the bravery of those who defend the weak and withstand the anger of the strong. So let's bravely stand too, with mothers, daughters, midwives, and princesses, and former governor generals.